Hello everyone, it's Tom here. Before we get into another brilliant episode of Last Orders, I've got a very special announcement to make. Spiked is about to celebrate its 25th anniversary. And to mark the occasion, we're hosting a bash in central London, bringing together the Spiked team, Spiked contributors, friends of Spiked, as well as the supporters, people who read our work, who donate every month, who really make what we do possible. So if you are a member of Spiked Supporters, our online donor community, you can get early bird tickets to this event, which is on the 27th of February in central London. There are only very limited places, so do move quickly. To find out more, go to the Supporters Hub on the website, and also keep an eye on your inbox because we'll be emailing all of our supporters with this offer. I really hope to see you all there. Also, I'm very excited to say that our internship program is open once again. So if you're looking to cut your teeth in journalism, if you're passionate about our pro-freedom politics, please do go to spiked-online.com/interns to find out more and how to apply. No experience is necessary. We're just looking for a hardworking person to join us 5 days a week here in London. It's a paid position and there's also prospects of work at the end of it. Once again, to find out more, go to spiked-online.com/interns. Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by my co-host, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
All right, thanks. Hello, listeners.
And also a big hello to returning guest Tamandra Harkness, the author of Technology is Not the Problem and Big Data, Does Size Matter? Tamandra, how are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on because there's been a huge story in the world of technology, in the world of artificial intelligence, specifically for the course of the past couple of weeks, which is the arrival onto the scene, or at least onto the radar of those of us who don't follow this issue particularly closely, of DeepSeek, this new AI tool, this new AI company, which has really exploded onto the scene, as I say, which seems to have ignited talk of there being a real kind of AI arms race between the US and China. Just wondering, Tamandra, just for those of us who, as I say, haven't necessarily been following the ins and outs of the AI revolution, as some people would call it, in recent years, what does DeepSeek really represent, its kind of emergence onto the scene here?
I think the reason it shocked people was not so much that China is producing AI on a similar level to the US, because all the US things that people have got familiar with the last couple of years, ChatGPT and the similar large, what they call large language models, which means that you can interact with them in a very natural human-like way, and they're very good at generating text, basically. So it's not really a surprise that China is up there with similar level AI, because China has been chasing AI very hard for a long time. And in fact, one of the justifications for making large amounts of data available to AI in the UK and the US is we need this, otherwise we'll be left behind China, because China is not so squeamish about using large amounts of people's data. But I think the reason why people were taken a bit by surprise was mainly that they claim to have done it much more cheaply and with much less technology than the Silicon Valley companies. And that's why it had a sudden impact on the tech stock market, because suddenly people thought, oh, we're being asked to put all this money into people like OpenAI and the big Silicon Valley AI companies. But maybe if China says they're doing it so much cheaper, maybe we shouldn't be throwing all this money at it. Maybe it is possible to do it cheaper. So I think that was the first shock. But then it also has these other elements. For example, DeepSeek made their technology openly available. Lots of people have it on their phones downloading it. So now there's some concern in the West about security and privacy, because just as when you use an open source ChatGPT and so on, you're basically throwing all your data into it, and the AI is, if you like, eating it and using it to train itself. If you have DeepSeek on your phone and you throw all your data into it, well, who knows who's getting access to that? Because there's always a kind of thin wall between private companies and governments. But in China, I think it's widely acknowledged that the government has very free access to what companies can do. I mean, at least if it wants to, the government can have access to things. So there is a ripple of concern about, oh, if you know, all these people in America and the West put DeepSeek on their phones, throw their data in, who knows what data is going back to the Chinese government. But I think commercially, the concern is that they seem to have done it much more cheaply. And then, if you like, the technology people are saying, oh, well, maybe if they can have done this, as they claim, with much less data and much fewer chips, basically, much fewer advanced microchips and less money, then we do have some serious competition because we need to be able to do it that cheaply.
And you were saying there about how people have raised concerns about the fact that this is a pretty advanced seeming Chinese made AI tool because of the stranglehold that the Chinese Communist Party ultimately has over business over there if they seek to exercise that power. But could that also be a bit of a hindrance to China developing AI? This was certainly, I suppose, some of the conventional wisdom was that could you really develop really top-notch tools in a situation in which you don't want a chatbot spitting out historically accurate information about what happened in Hong Kong or what happened in Tiananmen Square? There's been a lot of people on social media kind of showing screenshots of what DeepSeek has said to them when they do go down those kind of alleyways in terms of what questions they ask it. So what do we make of that aspect of this? Can, in terms of how an AI can operate and can develop in a authoritarian state?
Well, yes. I mean, it's got guide rails built in that very firmly will stop it giving answers that are politically awkward for the Chinese government. As you say, if you ask it about Tiananmen Square, you get no answer about the Tiananmen Square massacre, which is just a forbidden subject within China. And I'm sure there's lots of other topics as well. I mean, that's quite an interesting thing that people have pointed to that and said, this just shows how different it is in China. But in fact, of course, not state mandated, but there are lots of things here that if you ask things like ChatGPT or Claude, if you ask them questions about particular things, you will get particular kinds of answers. I mean, for example, I think maybe a bit scared by a few years ago, there was a chatbot that one of the companies released onto social media to freely interact with other social media users. And in no time at all, they trained it to be really racist. So I think rather alert to that, the big companies now build in guide rails to their own AI, which means that you can't get it to give you racist answers. And in theory, you can't get it to tell you how to make bombs and so on, although people have found ways to work around that. Actually, there's a fun fact here. If you want to avoid getting the AI answer, if you, I think, use Google, and if you ask it certain questions, then top of the results will be, oh, here's an AI-generated summary of the results. And if you don't want that, you just put a swear word into the question, and and it won't give you the answer. You'll just get the search results as normal. So there's an insider tip. If you don't want the AI-generated summary, you just put the word, can I say the word fucking? Anyway, I've just said it. You put the word fucking into your question and you won't get the AI summary. So see, there are guide rails over here. They may not be government mandated, but they are built in by the companies that built them. And I'm sure they have an eye on future and current government regulations and not wanting to cross over those lines.
A good way of protecting children from AI. Teach
yes, them exactly.
To put the F word into all the search terms.
They've got to learn these words at some point. Chris, any thoughts or questions for Tamandra here?
Well, I don't really know anything about AI, Tom, but that won't stop me talking about it for a few minutes. Don't worry about
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. That's what podcasting is all about.
I think AI is a load of rubbish. I think it's just a glorified search engine, really. But I did have my mind changed somewhat when I discovered Grok on Twitter, where you can make the pictures of people. In fact, I upgraded to Premium Plus so I can make more than 20 pictures an hour. And what interests me about that, apart from how funny and realistic the pictures are, is who when you obviously you put in celebrities, don't you, doing daft things. Well, that's what I do anyway. But it doesn't recognize all celebrities. And it's interesting to see where their threshold for fame is, really. So, for example, it's got Owen Jones, but it hasn't got George Monbiot. It's got Lucy Letby, but it hasn't got Peter Sutcliffe, and so on and so on. And I don't really see why they've set the threshold there. But also, I don't really see why they can't just search the internet for photos. I mean, I should be able to put myself in there, and it should just find pictures of me off the internet and adjust them, shouldn't they? Or is it to stop people bullying each other?
No, actually, I tried Grok, and got a bit sidetracked. I have not, thankfully, not paid for the extra, but I asked it for pictures of me. And they came up with this like very realistic photo, but of some completely different woman who doesn't look anything like me, although still wearing a Liverpool hat, which is what my Twitter avatar looks like. And then I said, okay, let's have pictures of me as a philosopher. And it was basically much the same, except I looked older and sadder, and the books in the room were also older. So it is, no, but I agree, it's very impressive. What they can do is very impressive, particularly generating images, and you think how fast they do it and so on. It's immensely impressive. And generating text is immensely impressive. But you have to remember what it's doing. It's a next token predictor. It's a glorified version of the predictive text you have when you're typing on your phone. It's just much, much more sophisticated. So instead of going, well, normally when you type, let's have another, Chris, right, then the next word is beer. But it, for the large language models, it's got the whole of the internet in there. So the things that it's going on are much more sophisticated. So it can produce much more sophisticated responses. And the DeepSeek, the Chinese one, is a thing called a reasoning model, which means that it will reproduce not only what's the likely next word, but what's the likely next word that makes sense according to, you know, human patterns of what makes sense. So they're very sophisticated, but what they don't do is have any relationship with the real world. And that's where I think they fall down and people become disillusioned, because people, I'm still hearing about students use them to write essays, and the essays are kind of coherent, but then all the references are books that the thing just made up. They don't even exist. And you really think, don't bother to do this. At least, you know, just Google the book and see if it exists before you submit it to your university.
It is impressive, and the grok is brilliant, but, you know, this, they've obviously got some way to go before you can get a picture of George Monbiot having a pint with the Yorkshire Ripper. That's all I'm saying. But the other point I was going to make from a stock market perspective is, I saw all the tech stocks collapse the other day, and that always brings me a lot of pleasure because I like to invest in real things that people actually use and buy, and companies make profit. But I do have shares in Palantir, the CIA-backed US organization that supposedly wants to privatize the NHS. And they've gone up 540% in the last couple of years, largely thanks to Trump getting in, because they get a lot of government contracts. And then it turned out only the other day that they had a huge boost in profits, because apparently they're immune from this AI bubble going pop, because they're really good at it or something like that.
Well, the thing is, we are tending at the moment, because ChatGPT burst onto the scene a couple of years ago and everyone went, oh, wow, look, it'll write me a sonnet in the style of Shakespeare about my toes, whatever. That is what is foremost in your mind when you think about AI, if you don't work in AI. But in fact, the really exciting, useful stuff has been going on for some time and is not necessarily that. It's just we don't interact with the stuff that Palantir is basically data organization and management, which is why they want to get it involved in the NHS. It's used to gathering and organizing immense amounts of data and then finding the data you want when you want it, which, I mean, clearly would be a good thing in a health service. The reason why people are squeamish about it is, as you say, because they do a lot of contracts for people like the CIA, and the idea that your health data might cross over into massive state surveillance machines is a bit uncomfortable, I think. I think the nice thing about your doctor supposedly was that you could go and say things to your doctor you wouldn't say to anyone else, and it would stay private.
Nothing to hide, nothing to fear, Andrew. I trust my health data more with Palantir than I would with some doctor.
And just finally, Tamandra, why not end on an enormous question, which is AI going to destroy the world or save the world? I mean, there's a spectrum of opinions on what this technology really represents. Some people who are saying that it is kind of a glorified, it's basically essentially capable of glorified party tricks at the moment. Other people saying this could have all kinds of useful applications. And then the kind of Silicon Valley set, who are basically claiming they're building the new god here, and that this is, depending on who cracks it first, it's either going to be a great boon to humanity or potentially our undoing. Where do you sit on that scale, I suppose, of what you think AI has in store for us in the near future?
Well, it's not going to do either. It's neither going to save the world nor destroy the world, because it's a range. I mean, the other thing is it's a range of technologies. It's a huge range between things like Grok and DeepSeek, which produce very plausible human-like things, but not necessarily reliable in terms of content. I mean, I still like to think of those in terms of being a very clever impro comedy group. If you wouldn't trust this job with an impro comedy group of bright people who know a little bit about a few things, don't entrust it to an AI. But then, you, as I say, you have really impressive advanced AI that's basically pattern seeking, that sorts enormous quantities of data much faster than a human ever could do and finds patterns. And that's why it's also very good at things like scanning health images and saying, oh, actually, I as a machine, this program has looked at 2 million images of this illness and has become very good at sorting this one's healthy, this one should a doctor should look at, or simply organizing stuff, just keeping very, very complex systems running at almost real-time speed and organizing data and predicting problems in transport systems or oil fields and things like that. It's very, very good at that. And it has already transformed our lives in that sense. So I think the problem is that the stuff that's actually very impressive and is already changing our lives tends to happen under the bonnet. And the stuff that is easy for us to interact with, like Grok and ChatGPT and DeepSeek, is good at what it's good at, but it's very easy for us to mistake that for a kind of human-like thinking when it's actually just really good at imitating.
Why isn't it increasing productivity, Tamandra?
Well, because people like you spend all your time looking at the artificial images of Peter Sutcliffe in a pub.
Nah. It's a double-edged sword.
Well, it is increasing productivity. I mean, as I say, the under-the-bonnet stuff is definitely, because it can just do routine data handling and processing tasks very, very efficiently. But also, I mean, people say, oh, do I use AI? And I'm always about to say no, and I go, oh, yeah, no, I do actually. I use transcription tools all the time. And that's transformed my productivity, because it's way quicker for me to check an artificial intelligence transcription than for me to sit there with my two finger typing and transcribe things myself. So things like that, yeah, they really will transform productivity. But will they either destroy the world or save the world? No, obviously not.
We do need to move on to some nanny state topics. But Chris, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about what some of these images you've been making are. Keep it clean, of course, but what sort of interesting combinations have you been working on? I saw one you showed me of Richard Madeley and Prince playing snooker, which was fantastic. But
yeah, I did some of Richard Madeley teaching Prince how to play pub sports. I did quite a lot of Wes Streeting eating junk food in a park. I'm just looking up now. I've got Rishi Sunak smoking and crying. Anna Soubry handing a burger to Nigel Farage. Chris Whitty eating some Skittles. Peter Hitchens playing snooker with Lucy Letby.
Brilliant. And we will return to Lucy Letby a little bit later on. But Chris, you wanted to talk about one of those debates that doesn't really die in the public health space, which is whether or not it's actually really expensive to eat healthily. This has raised its head again. Do you want to tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, I'm very fascinated by things that are obviously not true and should strike anybody as not true if they look around the world they live in or think about it for 3 seconds. A archetypal example is the idea that a third of 11-year-olds are overweight, which just is visibly not the case. But this example, I think, is even worse because, I suppose a lot of people don't spend that much time with children, might not think about it very much. But the idea that healthy food is expensive is so patently untrue that I don't know how the public health people get away with constantly saying that that it is expensive. So the Food Foundation, which is this big nanny state charity funded largely by the National Lottery and the Foreign Office for some reason, they come up with their broken plate report every year or two, in which they produce an astoundingly implausible estimate of how much it costs to buy so-called healthy food. And this year it was £8.80 for 1,000 calories of healthy food. So if for a man who needs 2,500 calories a day, that's £22 a day, the absolute minimum supposedly you have to spend in order to have a healthy diet. Even an unhealthy diet is £4.30 for 1,000 calories. Family of four, we're talking best part of £40 just for a healthy diet. Now, what is a healthy diet? Well, obviously fruit and veg is in there, starchy carbohydrates, rice, pasta, bread, all these things are cheap as chips, as it were. And you can pretty much fill a wheelbarrow with this stuff for less than £8.80. And there's two basic problems with the research that this is based on. The first is just like valuing food by per calorie is just a really weird way of doing it, right? Because healthy food, a lot of healthy food is quite low in calories, and that's why it's healthy, right? So there's a tautological aspect to this. So, you know, celery and cucumbers are very low in calories and probably will cost quite a lot to get 1,000 calories, you know, of coriander or something. But that's not why people are buying it. If they want the calories, they eat the bread and the rice and the pasta, all of which is really, really cheap. So as with a lot of things to do in nutrition these days, we look at it entirely through the lens of obesity and see calories as being a bad thing, where we should be looking at vitamins and nutrients and the other reasons that people eat green beans and so on in the first place. And the second thing is that this estimate is based on a study in which the researchers looked at nearly 6,000 food products that were available in supermarkets, so a huge range of food. And they took the median average, not the mean average, not that the mean average would be that much better, but the median average is worse. And the median average is the middle number, right, in any set of numbers. So they're completely ignoring the cheapest half of the food supply, which makes it very misleading straight away, because when people read that it costs £8.80 to have a healthy diet, they assume that's the cheapest they can get a healthy diet for, right? And inevitably, the BBC reported this as being the absolute minimum you need to spend, and that's such a large proportion of low-income households' diet that it would cost 70% of their entire disposable income in order to eat healthily. So it's excluding things like peas and carrots and potatoes that people actually do eat. And I don't know what the median item is for fruit and veg, for example, but let's say it's Marks and Spencer's bag of coriander. Yes, that's going to be very expensive per 1,000 calories. So it's a ludicrous system of measurement in the first place. But no one should even have to debunk it, because it's obviously bollocks. None of it makes sense. None of it scans with our real life experience of going into a supermarket where they pretty much can't give vegetables away. I bought some Brussels sprouts before Christmas, peak time for Brussels sprouts. The only time any normal person buys Brussels sprouts, they were like 15p for a bag. Well, I mean, what do they cost in July? They might as well give them away for free. And you get these morons from public health going, oh, we need to tax on healthy food and subsidize healthy. How are you going to subsidize healthy food? How are you going to do it? Well, you could subsidize farmers, but we already do that. So what are you going to do? You pretty much can't make it any cheaper. It's so cheap. People don't eat it because it doesn't taste very nice.
There is talk occasionally about prescribing things, isn't there? Like you'd go to the doctor and he'd give you some cabbages or whatever. They occasionally suggest that.
Yeah, in addition to your GP asking you about your gambling, which is the new one they got out. God, I'm like...
Two sprouts a day with food. Yeah. You're absolutely right. The way it's framed is all topsy-turvy. But I think one of the problems is the assumption is that poor people don't eat well. And the assumption is that processed foods are bad, and the more processed they are, the worse they are. And so this brings you to this triangle where what poor people ought to do is spend all their food on very unprepared food, like vegetables and uncooked rice and all this, and then prepare it and then eat it. And I think the thing that ignores is the reason why people like processed food. I mean, there's a bunch of reasons, but one of them is it's much quicker, especially if you've got a job and a family, it's much quicker to go and buy some pre-processed food and eat that,
and it tastes better. That's the key part of it. That's the main thing people look for in food, is taste.
Exactly. It is, and it is also often very, very nice, but it's this kind of vicious circle of you're expected to not only eat this very specified range of, yeah, you're right, mainly fruit and vegetables, but also you've got to cook it yourself. You've got to prepare it yourself. So it's the time that it takes. And I think, you're completely right. There's no way it costs £8.80 to provide yourself with 1,000 calories unless you're in, you know, reasonable price restaurant, frankly. But it's just another way of saying they're not going to subsidise vegetables, obviously. What they're going to do is tax processed food and find some other way of deterring you so that now you're on a limited budget, you're trying to do a job, maybe even two jobs, you've got kids to feed, and now you're also going to have to think, well, can I afford the extra to get the ready meal, or am I going to have to spend another half hour peeling things and chopping them and boiling them?
Exactly. Well, if you deep fry the vegetables, that would make them cheaper by the logic of these cretins. Except then it wouldn't be healthy anymore. So it's just you're just stuck in this catch 22 where unhealthy food is expensive by definition.
Air fryers, I think, are an absolute godsend.
I've never tried an air fryer
for home cooking. I haven't either, but my family, my relatives with kids are like, yeah, we just do this, we put it in the air fryer, it's fantastic. So maybe
take
this is the idea.
1,000 calories worth of coriander.
Yeah,
stick it
and
in the air
deep
fryer.
Fry it.
I'll have 1,000 calories of food, please, shopkeeper.
Maybe the government could just give out free air fryers to the poor. Maybe that's the answer.
Are they meant to be a lot healthier? Is that the idea of air fryers? Because you don't use fat.
I don't even
Are they just
care?
Like grills? I don't even really know what they are.
I think they're basically like someone looked at a fan oven and went, what if we turn the fan up a lot and made the oven smaller? I think it's that. I think it blows incredibly hot air through, but don't take me as authority in this because I
so
don't.
So it's a cross between an oven and a microwave.
No, it's not a microwave.
It's size of a microwave.
It's more like a deep fryer, but without the fat.
I wish deep fat fryers anyway, had come back. You don't get deep fat fryers anymore.
Can't.
How are there any house fires at all? No one has a deep fat fire and no one's smoking anymore. I think that all fires are arson. There's no other excuse for it. We've got modern electrics. Your fuses, you know, are all right. People aren't smoking. If they do smoke, they'll smoke outside. And no one uses deep fat fryers. So there's no innocent causes of house fires anymore.
No, it's lithium batteries.
Oh, is it?
It's electric bicycles and scooters.
And e-cigarettes blowing.
Because the batteries just spontaneously catch fire. So you think you're living a healthy life with an electric bicycle and then your house burns down.
All right, 90% arson.
Well, from your little conspiracy theory there, Chris, to another whole world of it, should we talk about Lucy Letby? Should we turn to Lucy Letby Corner?
Yeah. Shall we stroll towards Lucy Letby Corner?
Lucy Letby Corner.
And while we're there, let's open the postbag.
Postbag, postbag, postbag.
It's bulging, eh?
Yes, we should probably mix these two together because we do want you, Chris, to address the latest developments on the Lucy Letby front. There was a big press conference this week where her new defence had gathered together some purported experts to talk about, to air their conclusions, which is essentially that she isn't guilty of the crime she's been alleged, she's actually been prosecuted for, imprisoned for. But also we put this out on social media, and as you would expect, there have been a lot of questions about this particular development, but also the case.
Postbag really is bulging.
It is.
Week.
This week it really, really is. So Chris, first of all, do you want to tell us about the press conference this week, what was said at it, and what your response to it is? This story really isn't going away, so let's...
No, it's never, ever going to go away. It's a good job we set up Lucy Letby Corner as a regular item of the show only 2 weeks ago because it's been a very busy fortnight. The main lowlight of which was a press conference, the second in 2 months, featuring completely different experts. And these people are experts. I mean, they're eminent. Everyone's saying how eminent they are. So let's be very clear about that. These are eminent, distinguished people in the world of neonatology, even though nobody who's called him eminent ever heard of him before, but then why would you? It's a niche field. But there's no doubting that these people, you know, they know what they're talking about when it comes to neonatology. Whether they know so much about the actual court case in which Lucy Letby was found guilty is more debatable, and I'm not sure actually how much of the medical records they have looked at, because they've said some slightly strange things. Anyway, it's a guy called Professor Xu Li in Canada. He's try and cut this long story short, but Letby was convicted of quite a few instances of killing using air embolism. One of the pieces of evidence was a paper by this Xu Li, written in 1989, in which he gave a description, a sort of case studies of newborns who had air embolism. It doesn't happen very often, so it's not easy to know exactly what the symptoms are, and the symptoms do seem to vary. But one of the symptoms seemed to be, in some cases, that there would be a kind of a bluey red rash, and a lot of the doctors at the Letby's hospital said that they saw a purpley or a bluey pink rash flitting around on some of the bodies. And then one of the doctors came across this study by Xu Li, and he said a tingle went down his spine because he realized what was going on. And then Xu Li came back during her appeal saying, no, none of these blotches or anything like what I described in my paper. That was rejected as grounds for appeal because the judges said, yeah, well, there were other reasons to think it was air embolism aside from your paper. It wasn't that big a deal in the case. He then went off and decided that she was definitely innocent and sort of went expert shopping around the world to find people who would look at her case and come up with an alternative explanation. And so that's what we had at this press conference. We had this guy going through, I think, seven of the murders and attempted murders, saying, no, they weren't murders or attempted murders. They were either doctors cocking things up, or they were natural causes exacerbated by a badly run hospital, which is kind of the narrative you get from the pro-Letby people. I have to say that, you know, if I was going to change my mind about this issue, it would be on the basis of a whole load of distinguished scientists saying that Dowie Evans doesn't know what he's talking about, and this isn't how you do an air embolism, and the prosecution's case is a load of rubbish. In fact, I said that when I first started writing about this last year. There's no point talking about statistics and door swipe data and all this rubbish, because it's not going to get you anywhere. But if you can convince the public, and obviously primarily the appeals court, that the prosecution case was just a vague hypothesis, never had much behind it, then you know, if you can show there was no murders, obviously there was no murderer, and that's really your only path out of prison. However, having said that, I wasn't very impressed with what was said in their summary report. They seemed to be producing hypotheses that were already tested in court, so I don't think they would, appeals court wouldn't be interested in that at all. In one instance, you've got a supposed insulin expert who's actually a mechanical engineer. I'm not knocking him, but I mean, not exactly the best of the best for insulin research. And he kind of says, contrary to what we said in the previous press conference in December, when we said that these insulin tests were just wrong, we now think they're right, but actually the readings weren't that high. Well, they really were high by any definition at all. It's all it shows is that there are definitely different interpretations of these events, which some people would say introduces reasonable doubt. I don't think so. I think that there's a whole load more evidence in this case. I think that blaming the doctors is it's getting pretty ugly out there. We're blaming the people who blew the whistle on Lucy Letby and who had to fight with the hospital management to try and even get her out of the hospital, let alone get her prosecuted, I think is a bit below the belt. And of course, it would ultimately require a conspiracy, you know, and that's surely didn't go that far. But the gist of it is that doctors were accidentally killing these babies. There needed to be a scapegoat, and so they found Lucy Letby, who was the ideal person to blame since she was always there. And they were very lucky in that it turned out she was also writing down notes saying, I am evil, I did this, and keeping hundreds of handover notes and looking up dead babies' parents on Facebook on Christmas Day. So that was a touch for them, wasn't it?
And just to be clear, is it the case that what was presented this week isn't necessarily grounds to doubt that it was air embolism? Or is it the fact that that's the fact that the nature of the case was proving that these children had been harmed, not necessarily the precise way in which that took place. What's your objection here, I guess?
They're definitely saying none of them were air embolism, but they're also saying none of them were foul play. They go through seven of them, and there's 15 counts, by the way. They don't seem to have finished with the other eight yet. And say there's an alternative explanation. And I, like I say, I'm not qualified to really try and debunk any of this, but there have been a few red flags from what I know about the case, in which they're saying things that at the very least were rejected in court, and presumably with evidence they were rejected in court. I just don't think they're, you know, they might have familiarized themselves with some of the medical records, but they're definitely not familiar with the court case. Otherwise, they would know that a lot of this stuff has already been raised by the defense in the previous two trials, and indeed, in some cases, in the appeal. And given that, and given that appeals court need new evidence, I don't see it getting very far. It's an interesting question, by the way, whether just somebody disagreeing, even if you're an eminent person, whether you've got a different opinion, does that count as new evidence? I don't know. I mean, normally you'd probably think not. And I guess if it's just one person saying, I don't agree with Dowie Evans' interpretation of things, that obviously wouldn't lead to a retrial of a trial that went on for 10 months. But Dowie Evans' evidence itself was basically just his opinion, albeit backed up with actual evidence. So, look, we shall see. But I'll tell you what, no matter what happens, whether it goes to appeal or doesn't, this is just never, ever going to end. People are just going to be talking about this forever. And probably over time, more and more people are going to convince themselves she's innocent, and it's just this big call celebre. So just get used to it, really.
Tamandra, I don't know if you have any strong feelings either way about the Letby case. Otherwise, I can reach into the post bag and see if there's any questions. Chris can answer his critics.
I really don't. I mean, I didn't follow the case particularly closely. And I was asked, I think when people started raising doubts, I was asked because I have a very slight statistical involvement, because there was a particular question about, oh, it's misuse of statistics in a court, because what they did was they only looked at the cases where she was present and only looked at those deaths, not the other deaths. To which the flippant answer is, well, you wouldn't want to prosecute somebody for deaths when you weren't even there, would you? That would make no sense at all. But the sensible answer is, yes, but most of the case did not actually rely on that statistical correlation of she was there and the deaths. That might have been a factor in the doctor saying, this is awful and isn't it weird how she always seems to be on duty? But that was not, none of, as far as I know, none of the convictions rested on that. So at that point I said, well, all I'm going to say is, within the Royal Statistical Society, which I am a member of, opinion is divided on this, and there is a general report going to go out about use of statistics in court cases, which they've actually delayed doing until after her case was over, so that it wouldn't become embroiled in it. So no, over to Chris and the post bag.
Chris, I'm not sure if you saw if there's anything that you saw on social media. Let me group a couple of these together, because they are often kind of skating over sort of similar ground. The theory that seems to be put forward specifically is that the scapegoating theory, as you've already touched on, that there were general professional deficiencies in the hospital, that other things had been going wrong, and that Lucy Letby was essentially made a scapegoat for the hospital's failings. Now, I know that first of all, there's no kind of specific evidence of that's been pointed to, either online or in the case. But why is that so unlikely, would you say? I know this is sort of going back to the bare bones of this case, but just to articulate it, please do.
Well, you've got to think, okay, let's say these experts are right, for the sake of argument, let's say they're right, and actually these deaths were due to really badly run hospital and doctors being incompetent and accidentally killing babies. How do we get from there to Lucy Letby being in prison for 15 whole life terms? There was no pressure from anyone to investigate these deaths. On the contrary, the doctors themselves who supposedly killed these babies were the ones who were badgering hospital management, who were being told to shut up by hospital management. And they pushed on and on quite heroically and eventually got in touch with the police and did something about it. The people who were supposedly guilty, albeit of accidentally killing these babies, went out of their way to have it investigated, to go to trial, where, if you believe this conspiracy, whatever, they were lucky enough to find a whole load of experts who all went along with this idea that Lucy Letby had done it. She happened to leave loads of incriminating stuff in her house, and then led to worldwide attention being put on this hospital. So this hospital, which had had a spike in deaths that no one outside Chester had even noticed, and probably most people in Chester hadn't even noticed. It was just an internal problem. As David Spiegelhalter said, it was a kind of one in 150 shot, but you know, unlikely, but the kind of thing that on average will happen once a year in England. No one, you know, there was no point trying to cover it up because there was nothing to cover up. No one was interested in it. All they could risk doing was drawing attention to themselves, having to lie in court, as these people would see it. And then there's a Thirlwall inquiry that spends months and months, if not years, digging into how badly run this hospital was. The idea that this is the hospital trying to save its blushes is absolutely insane. Doesn't make a lick of sense.
Do you think that's what accounts, though, for this wide and persistent interest in doubting her guilt, that it taps into an underlying sense of distrust with the NHS and hospitals and institutions, and a sense that the institutions are always at fault, and all they do is go looking for an individual scapegoat, and that's what happened here. That it's less about the plausibility of this particular case, but it's more about tapping into that underlying sense of distrust with institutions in general and the NHS in particular.
I think that right-wingers like the theory because it shows how bad the NHS is, and the left wingers like the theory because it shows how the Tories underfunded it and are trying to sell it off, you know. So there is a political dimension to it. There's other things too. I mean, the fact that she doesn't look the type, and she's a, you know,
mm-hmm. Which also comes up in the postbag, I should say. So I'm glad you're addressing that.
There are various different reasons, and you know, and the fact that it's a genuinely intriguing case, and there is no smoking gun, and you know. It's circumstantial evidence. It's something that people can debate forever and probably will.
I do think that whilst this isn't true of all of the people who've got very exercised about this case, I think there's an element of people having caught the conspiratorial bug to a certain degree and maybe now kind of applying that to other cases that previously they might otherwise not have. Tamandra, before we ask the final question that we ask all of our guests, we also had a question going way back to AI, funnily enough, about NVIDIA, I never know how to pronounce it, the chip makers, because that was one thing about the DeepSeek story, which I understand it was one of the things that made it so shocking, was that there had been these export controls on NVIDIA chips, which were believed to be that those controls were seen as a way that they were going to keep kind of China out of the AI race. So a lot of questions raised about, and the drift of this question in the postbag was, did maybe DeepSeek have access to these chips all along and America just didn't know about it? What do you think about that particular question?
Well, there is a theory that they found them via other channels, that they weren't officially allowed to import them into China, but obviously there are indirect channels via, I think there was a question about they could have gone via Singapore, and that is always possible. But it seems likely that DeepSeek stockpiled the previous generation of NVIDIA chips, so the most advanced that were allowed to be imported, before they tightened up the controls still more. And so they had a good stock of, like, not the latest ones, but the ones before that. But there is also, I think, part of the disquiet is that it seems as if possibly the lack of having the most advanced chips forced them to be more creative and forced them to go, all right, well, we don't have the most advanced, fastest chips. And they used some for this kind of scale of operation, ridiculously few. I think it was about 1,000 chips. Which is impressive to produce something of this scale on that few. And that is part of the idea, is that they were forced to be more creative by the cutting off of the most advanced chips and the quantity of them. And so they found other ways to work with them, which obviously is going to be to their benefit in the long term. I mean, the control of microchips is an immense geopolitical thing. And that's one of the reasons why Taiwan is such a hot potato, is because so many of the chips used all over the world are manufactured there. At one point, they had pretty much a monopoly, which I don't think is the case anymore. But yes, yeah, so the idea that America cuts off the supply of the NVIDIA advanced chips and then China comes up with this anyway, I think would make them very disquieted. I think it also had some impact on Nvidia's stock prices, although I think that's recovered now.
So before we let you go, Tamandra, we do ask all of our guests this final question because we are very libertarian anti-ban. If you did have to have one ban, what would it be? And the only rules are it can't be worthy, or it's got to be something that just irks you on a personal level.
All right. Well, I was actually genuinely thinking this last week that there should be a read the room law for the internet, where if a company or something has sent you an offer, has invited you to subscribe or sent you a 30% off the disc for a certain number of times and you have ignored it and left it in the junk folder and deleted it, then they should be forced by law to read the room and give up and go away. And I'm prepared to be very liberal and libertarian on this and say they're allowed to do it 8 times or maybe even a year. They could do it for a year. And then after that, it's like, no, I'm sorry. It's like, just take the hint. All right, I've not subscribed. I'm not going to subscribe. If in the future I change my mind, I can use a search engine and come back and find you. So, I mean, it's a small thing, but I don't think it's unreasonable.
You're being very liberal by saying 8 times or a year. I would have said 2.
Well, I am just naturally very liberal and libertarian, Chris.
Well, but you're just going to get, how much junk mail are you getting? I wouldn't put up with that. Just, you can block them.
Oh, quantities, absolute quantities. But it was every day I check my junk folders and there it is. Same old hopeful companies. Hey, 30% off. It's like, read the room, mate, read the room.
I get quite a bit of stuff from public affairs, well, various little public affairs things, random universities. They think I'm a health reporter. So I get loads of stuff about health. And have you, you know, here's some interesting facts about Jai January. Would you like to tell your readers about it? Well, absolutely not, no.
But then you do.
But then they follow up going like, hi, Chris, just checking in to see if you got my email about this and that. But if they do it 3 times, they get a rude message.
There we go.
Once you're on these main lists, you can never get off.
There you go. I think this gets everybody's vote then, the read the room rule. And we just need to haggle about how many times. Or maybe you can set it. Maybe you should have a dial in your own computer and you set it. It's like, what's the maximum number of times somebody can bother you before they should just give up and go away?
Absolutely. It's an idea whose time has come.
That's definitely.
Great. Chris, Tamandra, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.